You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias. Hey everyone, today's episode is part two of the conversation with John Levinson about child sacrifice in the Bible. If you haven't heard part one, we'd recommend going back to listen to that one for some more context on where this episode kicks off. We talked in part one about evidence in the Hebrew Bible for the ancient practice of child sacrifice, namely of the firstborn son. But here in part two, we talk about how even though the practice was eradicated, the idea of child sacrifice lived on and was transformed in various ways, even into the New Testament.
Yes, so if you enjoy the first 10 minutes and you're not already signed up for our online community, head to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/join, where you can listen to the rest of part two and get access to all of our classes and courses as well.
John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son. He gave his only son. This brings us back to where we began with Exodus 22:29. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me sacrificially. Clearly, I think there is an inner biblical midrash in which the New Testament is reframing biblical stories, especially the binding of Isaac, applying that language to the figure of Jesus and relates this whole question of child sacrifice.
All right. Well, welcome back again, John, here for part two. We're going to keep the conversation going around child sacrifice and the implications for the Bible.
Well, thank you very much for having me again. I enjoyed our previous conversation. I look forward to this one.
Okay. Well, just as a reminder for folks, we'd set up this tension that we find in the Hebrew Bible around passages that talk about God finding sacrifice, child sacrifice, abhorrent, and something to be avoided at all costs. But in some ways, you said even those maybe are protesting too much to a tradition that it was happening. And then we looked at some texts where it doesn't seem to be as abhorrent as these prophetic texts indicate it at some point in the tradition. And we sort of ended that conversation thinking about when did that shift in the tradition where we find this condemnation of child sacrifice? And we were talking about like the 6th century BCE. So this is about 500 years before Jesus comes onto the scene and we get the New Testament and all of that. But can we talk a little bit before we get into how this gets carried forward in history? Maybe go back to the beginning and say, you know, while child sacrifice itself, maybe the practice of it became no longer practiced and condemned, and this is not something we do, it's abhorrent. The idea seems to live on, and we see that in some of the texts that we talked about, where we, you know, when we talk about redemption or being bought back or substitution, when we talk about the plague narratives, and the idea does come up again and again, even if not a practice, that seems to be in the air. So can you talk about, you know, why did it need to persist as an idea? Why do we have this longevity, even if the practice is no longer, it's no longer practiced, it's condemned, but it seems to be baked into the tradition over and over again. You know, why might that be?
You know, that's an excellent question. I wish I could answer it in some convincing way. I think that we're dealing with a very conservative, traditional culture. We're dealing with a culture that's increasingly textual, where the texts are written or oral, whether they're recited and memorized or read or some combination of the two, which I think the last option is the most realistic. And so you couldn't just take something in the name of God and that's out there and is traditionally revered and copied by scribe and recited and simply throw it out the door. You couldn't really do that. There are people like Thomas Jefferson or whatever who are happy to rewrite a Bible or cut out large parts of it. But in antiquity, you tended to augment and interpret. You didn't overthrow. You didn't generally excise. I'm not saying nothing was excised, but you see, let's say Deuteronomy, the Deuteronomic law code, reworking the collection of law you have in Exodus 21 through 23, for example, clearly introducing innovations, but Exodus 21 through 23, the older version is still there. So it's not a question of replacement. It's a question of augmentation and interpretation. So in that sense, you're going to have the older texts that were not negative on child sacrifice, or maybe even seem to reward it or have a high view of it or to require it. You have them still sitting there as time has gone on. I also would think that maybe, without even being a Freudian, the term I mentioned last time, sublimation, maybe does play a role in this. In other words, you have a substitution of the paschal lamb for the consecrated son. This is very explicit, that the paschal story, the story of the lamb, even the whole story of the Exodus, in part functions as an etiology, as a causal explanation, as a grounding for this practice of offering the sheep in place of the firstborn son. So, for example, here I'm reading from Exodus 13:2 from the New Revised Standard Version. Consecrate to me all the firstborn, kaddishly, make them holy, consecrate them to me. Whatever is the first to open the womb among the Israelites of human beings and animals is mine. In other words, one reason why it survives is it's a way of acknowledging concretely that God is the giver of this bounty, of the firstborn of the flock, of the herd, or of the human womb, and therefore it has to be offered to God. When in the future your child asks you, what does this mean? And the child will say, well, what are you doing? What is this crazy thing you're doing? You shall answer, by the strength of hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt from the house of slavery. When Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from human firstborn to the firstborn of animals. Therefore, I sacrifice to the Lord every male that opens, the first opens the womb, but every firstborn of my sons I redeem. And this is something you're supposed to remember. It is to serve as a sign on your hand, an emblem on your forehead, that by strength of hand, the Lord brought you out of Egypt. So to this day, when Jewish men put on the tefillin, the phylacteries, as it's translated into Greek, not the best term, this passage is there. It's a constant reminder. It's a reminder of the redemption of the Exodus, which was secured through this lamb. So it serves as an etiology for continuing practices, even when it, the child sacrifice itself, is no longer practiced and, in fact, abominated and seen as a horrible thing to be doing. But nonetheless, it grounds something else. It also grounds priestly service as a form of giving a person to God. I mean, the Levites in Numbers 8 are taking the place of the firstborn. And because they're more firstborn than the Levites, then you have a redemption process. And this is what in Judaism is called Pidyon HaBen, the redemption of the firstborn, practiced to this day. To this day, if a Jewish woman has a firstborn child as a son, there's not been a miscarriage, there's not a previous child, it's not a cesarean section, therefore it's the son who opens the womb, Peter Rechem, as they understand it, the one who's opening the womb. The father then buys that child back, so to speak, from the Kohen, from the priest, from the line of Aaron. This is practiced to this day. So at some level, it was sublimated, it was no longer literally practiced, but it was still, in a sense, fulfilled through these substitution rituals. Now, here's my question. Would Jeremiah or Ezekiel have approved of this? Last time we talked about Jeremiah and Ezekiel condemning this. Would they approve of this sublimation rather than eradication? I would say the prophets didn't totally win. The fact that these texts, especially priestly texts in the Bible, speak positively of these substitution rituals suggests that at the deep psychic level or the deep cultural level, it was still there. In the deep structure of the ancient Israelite mind and the continuing Jewish mind, and we'll see if you want to get into this early Christian mind, this was alive and well, the special sacrificial destiny of that firstborn son, and the father who was prepared to give up the son remained alive, even if there are substitutions, or even if, as in the case of the New Testament, the son is back 3 days later. Nonetheless, there's some drive to do this that remained a powerful psychic and cultural reality.
Before we go to the New Testament, you mentioned a couple of places where there's this collective symbolic use. You mentioned the tribe of Levi in Numbers 8, but I think it might be helpful before we move to the New Testament to talk about Exodus 4:22, where Israel is named also as God's firstborn, because it seems to be a motif or a theme that gets borrowed in the New Testament as well. So can you speak to that use?
Yeah, well, of course, you've got this very complicated and ambiguous text that people have been arguing about for thousands of years. I think it's, if I remember, Exodus 4:22-24, something like that, where you've got a circumcision, apparently, of Moses' son, so that God would not proceed with his attack on Moses. All very, very ambiguous. And then the mother says, the child is Chatan Damim, which would be mean something like a bridegroom of blood, but maybe a pun on a word having to do with circumcision. All very unclear. There are those who think, I suggest this in the death and resurrection of the beloved son, that maybe circumcision in some circles was also thought of as one of these substitution rituals. except it's not just the firstborn son. It's all Israelite men and even members of their household, slaves, non-Israelite slaves whom they buy, who have to be circumcised. But then what does Moses say when he gets to Pharaoh? I think something like, B'ni Bukhari Yisrael, Israel is my firstborn son. Israel is the firstborn son of God, which is to say, has the highest status, has a special status, has a preferred status, is the heir, so to speak. And a similar claim is made in Psalm 89 about David, where God says he will make David his firstborn son. He will promote him to the status of the firstborn. So there's a special destiny, which is, on one hand, a sign of their special favor of the chosen people, special favor to God, that they have this high status and this intimacy with God. But it's not scot-free. It's not just a gift. It comes with a kind of sacrificial destiny. There is suffering and sacrifice and affliction involved in this. You certainly see throughout the Torah a lot of suffering and affliction and pain inflicted on the firstborn son, which is to say, the people of Israel. So there's a kind of two-sidedness to this. And what I suggest in the book is this is also true of a lot of stories in the Bible, like Joseph is the firstborn to his mother, who is the only wife that Jacob has ever said to have loved, Rachel, the preferred wife, the firstborn son of the preferred wife. And he goes through a living hell. His brothers decide to kill him, and they sell him to slavery, and he goes through all kinds of hell until he finally emerges triumphant. I think that is a kind of narrative equivalent of the same sort of ritual. Think of the hell that Isaac, the firstborn, in fact, only son of his mother, Sarah, goes through in the Akedah, in the binding of Isaac, until he too emerges unscathed and with his father given a great promise that then is renewed to Isaac himself in chapter 26. So there's two sides to this. I think to some extent the New Testament continues that pattern of the chosen preferred son who also undergoes horrific, a brush with death, out of which he then emerges triumphant. I think that's a very strong pattern, a narrative pattern in the Hebrew Bible that corresponds at the narrative level to the rituals we're talking about.
Thanks again for listening in on the first part of Part 2 with John Levinson. To listen to the rest of this episode, head to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/join to become a member of our online community, the Society of Normal People. Once you join, you can also get access to all of our classes and courses, as well as a great community asking hard questions about the Bible and theology. We'll be back to our regularly scheduled programming next week, so stay tuned.
You've just made it through another episode of The Bible for Normal People. Don't forget you can catch our other show, Faith for Normal People, in the same feed wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was brought to you by the Bible for Normal People team. Brittany Hodge, Stephen Henning, Wesley Duckworth, Savannah Locke, Tessa Stoltz, Danny Wong, Natalie Wyand, Lauren O'Connell, Jessica Shao, and Naomi Gonzalez.
Hey Leute, hier ist Max Giesinger und ich habe mir gerade Harry Potter und das verwunschene Kind angeguckt. Was eine geile Show, könnte ich mir direkt nochmal reinziehen. Sichert euch jetzt Tickets unter harrypottertheater.de.
Bis Sommer 2026. Ein letztes Mal Magie.
Nur noch für kurze Zeit, also husch husch in den Warenkorb mit den Tickets.